It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. What some call political correctness has been a criticism against the left from conservatives for quite a while. Democrats often dismiss the right's disdain for, quote, PC culture as insensitive, retro, and sometimes even bigoted. But since the Democrats' defeat in November, some within the Democratic Party have come to blame political correctness and the left's focus on identity politics in particular as a reason why Hillary Clinton lost. Just yesterday, Bernie Sanders, asked by a questioner how she could become the second Latina senator in U.S. history, Sanders replied that a candidate's gender or race isn't enough. He said, according to transcripts, "I have to know whether that Latina is going to stand up with the working class. It's not good enough for someone to say, I'm a woman, vote for me. No, that's not good enough." Adding, "One of the struggles that you're going to be seeing in the Democratic Party is whether we go beyond identity politics," unquote, from Bernie Sanders. Now, over the weekend, Mark Lilla's essay in the New York Times became the number one shared piece from the Times website. It's called "The End of Identity Liberalism." Mark Lilla, professor of the humanities at Columbia University, also a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation, was just on the program recently for his new book, "The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction." And he joins me now to talk about this essay and the response to it. And with us with a response is George Yancey, professor of philosophy at Emory University and author of "Look, a White: Philosophical Essays on Whiteness." So, Professor Lilla, welcome back. Professor Yancey, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Mark Lilla, you say that while celebrating diversity is a splendid principle of moral pedagogy, it's disastrous as a foundation for democratic politics. What makes it disastrous?
Well, what makes it disastrous is that it doesn't provide a narrative to the country as a whole, a narrative that especially will attract people in the vast middle of this country, both geographically and in every other sense, economically, and religiously. The focus on our differences has taken our eye off the ball. We need to absorb the fact that Donald Trump, of all people, is now the president of the United States. It's not just a question of the Electoral College. Liberalism has lost its grip on the national narrative that is now owned by Republicans, and it's protected by a truth filter that's been established by Fox News and by conservative radio hosts. If we're going to get serious again about actually winning, even a dirty victory as opposed to a morally pure victory, we must find a way to get our act together, our message together, to get past that filter and to reach people in the middle of the country who will respond to it and see that we're speaking about their concerns.
But in terms of identity politics, what does that mean? Not embracing the Black Lives Matter movement, not embracing gay marriage as a principle for the Constitution. How do you be inclusive in the way that the Democrats, believe their values to be reflected by without engaging in some of this, just because the politics around the issues often breaks down on identity lines in real life?
I don't think it does. I think when we – by identity, we mean something special. We mean someone's self-definition. It's self-referential. It's not persuasive. It's expressive. When we defend Black motorists who are being stopped by policemen unfairly, who are being treated roughly, who are being shot, we are standing up for a principle of the law. And we can convince people that we need to convince people that this is a principle and, two, that it should apply to everyone. The same goes for the harassment of gays and lesbians and transgender people in this country, that they deserve the protection of the laws. And so if we stress the principle and the fact that the principle covers all of us, that it's our common property, We can both defend people who need defending and get on board people who are in fact in favor of these principles.
But then take me one more step before we bring in Dr. Yancey for a response. Where's the line? Because I would imagine that Hillary Clinton, as the case in point here, would say she was defending precisely those principles, and therefore it was how she talked about what amount to black issues or gay issues or pick your group.
Well, no. In her rhetoric, what she often did at every stop, and she was persuaded to do this by the people in her campaign, that it would be enough just to get out the vote in various groups, is to call out to particular groups, to African Americans, to LGBT community, to women. And these are vast portions of the country. Women are the majority in this country. But to even use that language is to sound in the ears of people who are in the Fox News bubble that we have to reach exclusionary. And when you speak of principles as such, you're able to pierce through that. It's a question of narrative, but it's also a question of public sentiment. Someone sent me a sentence from Abraham Lincoln, one of his speeches. He said, "Public sentiment is everything. With it, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing succeeds. He who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes." We need to reach people where they are, where their sentiments are, and to get them on our side.
Dr. Yancey, what would you like to reply to first?
Yeah, a few things. There's a lot in the piece that I disagree with, but I appreciate Mark for writing the piece. That's very important in terms of opening up dialogue. But just take the Black Lives Movement for an example. It's not just that the Black Lives Matter movement is self-referential. It is certainly that, to the extent that black people have suffered for hundreds of years in this country. So really the Black Lives Matter movement is about a human movement. And actually, if one thinks about the Black Lives Movement, it's possible to say that Black Lives Matter, while at the same time saying that all lives matter. In fact, embedded in the Black Lives Matter movement is the universal that all lives matter. But whenever you have individuals saying white lives matter, it does not logically follow, nor has it historically followed, that all lives matter. So the idea that Black Lives Matter is a kind of identificatory politics, I think, is to say that it's exclusively that is deeply problematic. But I would agree with Mark I would argue that Clinton did, in fact, she missed a certain opportunity in a certain demographic, namely the white, struggling and suffering working class. But Trump precisely played, I think, what Mark is calling a kind of identity liberalism by appealing not only just to class, but to whiteness, what I'd say is a structural binary. It wasn't as if, you know, working class whites heard Trump's message about anti-establishment and thought he's our guy, right? Rather, they also heard his racist xenophobic narrative, which is precisely an identificatory narrative. So if you want the psychology of this, then, I mean, it seems to me that it's not just about working class, it's about the way in which the white working class felt the sting of a kind of lack of recognition, precisely not only because of their working class, but because they're part of the white racist vanguard. So it's that reaction of not just suffering under class, but also the sense in which they have been left out of a certain kind of white narrative. So I would argue that undergirding Mark's piece is that it's not that we ought to engage in a post-identity politics or in a post-identity liberalism, but that we ought to critique whiteness, which has always been a structural identity politics.
Mark, go ahead.
Well, to begin with, as I say in my piece, Black Lives Matter has given a lesson to the conscience of all America. I mean, there's been some acting out as well. But I agree entirely. I mean, on this score, the only reason Black Lives Matter is that all lives matter. If all lives don't matter, then Black lives don't matter, right? But there's a difference
between
Well, there's a difference between saying all lives matter and white lives matter, which is what was suggested, and that's absolutely right.
Yeah, but all lives matter. Yeah, sorry, all lives matter is actually a kind of universal that black people cannot existentially afford to speak. They have to say black lives matter because it's their lives that aren't mattering. And embedded, I'm arguing, within black lives matter discourse is the language of the universal, because when you are the wretched of the earth, within
but
that...
But then it's embedded. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I'm just saying that the Black Lives Matters discourse is already a universal claim, you see, because when you're the damned of the earth, when you're the least of these, when you say that my life matters, you already mean that all lives matter. So it's the failure of America to respect black life. That is the problem. It's not the failure that we fail to recognize all lives matter. It's the denigration of black bodies in America.
Well, this is true. The problem is there, but it is not – you're talking about an implicit message. That is not explicit to people. That is not the way some people are reading it.
It's
the way I read it.
It's
the way I read it, but not other people. Let me give you an example. You know, there's this now famous Saturday Night Live skit that was sort of a Jeopardy show, and there were three black actors on the panel, and the moderator is black, and you have Tom Hanks dressed as a good old boy, and there's some questions are asked, and what develops in the skit is that, in fact, Tom Hanks's concerns are also the concerns of the black people on the panel, that they agree about economic things, they agree that they've been ignored by an elite and all the rest. And then the last question in the skit is fill in the blank, X lives matter. And all four of the black actors look at the white man who kind of stumbles and says, well, I kind of think all lives matter, and they turn away.
Yeah, and of course
and
the problem with that – yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Now, if you followed – how that went down on Fox News and conservative media, you know you have a problem. And if you want to win and not just score a moral victory, but win, you've got to pay attention to that.
George, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, sure. Actually, I saw that Tom Hanks. I saw the Saturday Night Live piece. The problem, of course, is that Tom Hanks, after the show, and I'm not even meaning Tom Hanks, but his character, can theoretically leave that show and go out and not be killed because he's showing his wallet, right, that doesn't get translated into a gun. So, still there's a ways in which his white privilege carries him outside of that show, that is to say the character. But the problem is, like, in your piece, one example, you argue that liberals should bear in mind that the first identity movement in American politics was the KKK, which still exists. Those who play the identity card should be prepared to lose it. I mean, that's false. It's not the case that the KKK was the first movement in American politics. I mean, if you think about Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, that was all about whiteness. If you think about by 1691, Virginia had already passed laws that said that if a white woman were to marry someone who's a Negro or an Indian who's a Latino or who's mulatto, she would be kicked out of the Dominion of Virginia. So already you have a white politics of identity in this country, right? So prior to that, so your advocation for a kind of post-identity liberalism. And if by that you only mean that certain groups should not be excluded or placed under erasure, then you and I can agree with that. But the problem is that the problem is not inherent with identificatory politics. When black people and people of color and disabled people and queer people and people who are of Muslim orientation, when they're arguing about their identities, it's not as if they're playing some identity card. They're saying, recognize our humanity. And the problem with Trump is his victory was not because he had some greater ethical universalism. His victory was predicated precisely on a discourse of xenophobia, racism, and sexism, which is precisely playing into an identity politics. So if you're going to remind us to go beyond a kind of identity liberalism, then we have to critique Trump as as well and institute a kind of, let's call it a humanity identity, if anything, right? But it seems to me that...
It just seems to me
that the discourse that propelled Trump forward, it was not because, simply because you had these poor whites who were struggling, which we all ought to empathize with and sympathize with. It's not just that. They didn't, like, bring out a metric and said, oh, yeah, we're being missed out on because we're the poor working class or the working class. They bought into Trump's racism and his xenophobia. That's why Trump won.
Well, to begin with, I think you overestimate the role of that in his election vastly. But nonetheless, on the other points you're making about the condition of Black America, racism in America, by Ku Klux Klan, I meant a self-conscious movement outside of government initially, with a whole metaphysics of whiteness.
But the metaphysics of whiteness had preceded that. That's the problem.
Right, but it was not, well, in any case, it was not distilled into a movement that had the effect. But nonetheless, let's say we agree about all of that. I'm trying to get you and other liberals to focus
I'm
on
not
the
a
fact
liberal.
That
I'm not
we,
a liberal.
Well, fine.
I'm a humanitarian.
Fine. Whoever, non-Trump voters. I want to convince non-Trump elite voters and opinion makers that we lost. We have lost since 1980. The narrative of the country has been taken. It's not just a question of the presidency. More than 30 governorships are Republican. More than 30 state legislatures are Republican. In 24 states, we have both a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. If we can't go out and start winning back state legislatures and governorships in places where the gerrymandering goes on, where the unwillingness to apply civil rights legislation to defend Black motorists goes on, where a blind eye is turned to LGBT people, if we can't go on and capture those governments, this is just talk. We have to win, period.
I'm really enjoying listening to the two of you have this discourse. And I hate to even jump in because this is at a high level. But we only have a few minutes. And I want to throw one other thing out there for both of you, just because you're both college professors. And if you're just joining us, Mark Lilla from Columbia and George Yancey from Emory on Mark Lilla's widely shared op-ed in the New York Times, saying that too much identity politics contributed to Hillary Clinton losing the White House and contributes to Democrats losing a lot of races these days. The idea of PC culture, quote unquote, is often most associated with college campuses. And I'm wondering if you can just both talk a little bit about how you encounter it at your school as a professor, and if you think it's changed and become either more constructive for society by flourishing again, I think, in recent years, or more destructive. Mark, I know that you've said that education is in part to blame for the rise of PC culture. So you want to go first?
Yeah, well, I mean, my experience in university is that this seems to come in 25-year waves. I mean, in the 60s and the early 90s and then now. It must have something to do with intellectual generations. I'm not sure. But in my day-to-day work, I just deal with my students, and I don't get involved in university politics, though a law professor at Columbia published an article in the Los Angeles Review of Books yesterday calling me a white nationalist and comparing me to David Duke for my article. So that's the reality. That's the reality on a number of campuses, but the problem there are two problems with PC on campus. One is it is simply handing a weapon for Fox News and Republicans to beat us with. If you're getting worked up about your pronouns and your Halloween costumes, how is that going to be read in the rest of the country? You need a sense of proportion. But the problem with PC is that it encourages in young people something they already have, which is narcissism. As young people, they're naturally narcissistic. Social media makes them more narcissistic. And their idea of politics is to begin with their identity and to spend a lot of time thinking about what it is, and then to become political to the degree that it affects the identity the way they've defined it, rather than thinking about an analysis of society as a whole, which Marxism provided one version of that, and a picture of where we go and how society works, and about reaching an entire country and fighting to be able to govern it for what you believe
in. But are you two just talking past each other in the way that you're talking as a political strategist who deep down believes in liberalism, whatever that is, and George is talking about his notions of reality as it exists? Does your notion of reality not conform with his, or just your sense of what's going to win elections and not alienate Fox News viewers?
Good question.
No, actually, I think George and I probably agree on a lot of things about what's, you know, we may disagree about how to talk about it, but agree about what's going on out there. What I haven't heard from him, I'd be interested to hear, is what's your plan? What is your plan for actually taking back the nation and capturing the national narrative?
Yeah. Can I speak now?
Please.
Yeah, I don't think that's incumbent upon me. I don't think I need to answer that question, quite frankly. You wrote the article, and I appreciate your having written it. But I want to say first, I think that it's not that there was too much identity liberalism that led to Hillary Clinton's not winning. I just think that it was too much white identificatory politics that led to Trump's win. And I also want to say that I think you and I do differ in terms of our pedagogical orientation. I mean, in my classes, look, I mean, I teach courses called Critical Whiteness Studies, Critical Philosophy of Race, and African-American Politics, right? I mean, African-American Philosophy. So you might say, oh, identity is all in there, right? But no, what it is, it's an attempt to critique powers and structures that exist in American society. And it's an attempt to communicate with people who are black, who are people of color, who are disabled. I took a course where I was just floored because I kept using, talk about pronouns, I kept using the wrong terms to describe individual people. So I didn't use the term transgender correctly. I didn't use the term cisgender correctly. Now, those issues are extraordinarily important. They are existentially important for people's identity. So I think that, Mark, part of your problem is that you think this is an either-or situation or disjunct. We can do two things. We can talk about the ways in which identities suffer, the way in which black people, people of color, disabled, cisgender, you name all those categories, transgender, the way in which they have to suffer every day of their lives, while at the same time making an appeal to a certain kind of universalism that is much more inclusive. So in my pedagogical practices, I practice what's called paideia, or what's called bildung, right? These ideas, it's about education as a form of educare, as a form of moving out. So implicit in that, in fact, explicit in that form of pedagogy, is the universal. So it's not that, I think that the idea that you're working with is a false dichotomy. That dichotomy doesn't have to exist at all in terms of the way in which one approaches one's the way in which one engages one's critical pedagogy. In fact, I would even want to do away with the language of PC. That language is already deeply problematic. Why don't we just talk about the ways in which all of us as human beings, particularly within the United States, suffer across various axes? And so if you want my take on this, my sort of what's next, right? I think that we need a beloved community, which then speaks higher to the politics of Clinton and also higher, certainly higher, to the politics of Trump. I think that we need a kind of radicalization of a certain kind of humanism in the United States that we have not seen. And part of that humanism will involve a critique of whiteness, which I see as the core core side of hegemony within this country.
And you know what? The clock determines, as probably does the state of humanity, that we will not solve all of philosophy and politics in this conversation, and we're going to have to leave it here. So I really appreciate both of you engaging. Mark Lilla, professor of the humanities at Columbia University, who wrote the essay, The End of Identity Liberalism, in this Sunday's New York Times that's been so shared online. He's also the author of The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction, and George Yancey, professor of philosophy at Emory University and author of Look, a White, Philosophical Essays on Whiteness. Thank you both so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, George.
Brian Lehrer.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More in a minute.